I'm Jessica Harris, and welcome to my welcome table.
I'm going to be at the welcome table.
Gather round this special table. It's scarred with memories, pitted with burn spots from hot skillets, and decorated with moisture rings from frosty glasses of lemonade, beer bottles, bourbon and ginger ale, and untold goblets of red wine. This table will be our flying carpet as we travel around the world. I'll share some of my secret spots. We'll meet new friends and reconnect with old ones. Sometimes, the table will be covered with fine Porthot linen and my mother's bone china, and we'll sup on caviar and champagne. Other times, we'll cover it with yesterday's news and hanker down for a crawfish boil or a lobster supper. Whatever the meal, by the end of our time together, we'll have shared some special friends, sacred spots, and the food, drink, and music that connects them. So come, join me at my welcome table.
Hi, my name's Mitzi Pratt, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
I'm Patrick Dunn, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is John Barkley, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is Anne McBride, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
I'm Betty Fussell, and I, too, am sitting at the welcome table.
Compass points, 25.78 degrees north, 80.21 degrees west, Miami, Florida.
Miami, South Beach, bringing the heat, can y'all feel that, jig it out.
We all know that the Fountain of Youth was not what Juan Ponce de Leon found when he sailed into what is today known as Biscayne Bay in 1513. Indeed, it's not even known if he went ashore on that voyage. What he did at least view was an area inhabited by the Tequesta Indians. The Spaniards attempted to colonize, but by the late 16th century, they decided to seek greener pastures on the Florida Peninsula. Ironically, they conquered in absentia, leaving behind a range of diseases, including smallpox, that decimated the native population. In the mid-18th century, the British tried as well, but Samuel Touchet, who had received a land grant of 20,000 acres with the purpose of colonization, don't you just love colonial history? Well, Touchet had financial problems and was without sufficient funds to really establish a colony, so he failed as well. By the end of the 18th century, the Tequesta were virtually gone, and the Spanish had moved on to other places, and the British were still without a foothold. The Declaration of Independence was written, and the Revolutionary War over, by the time that the Miami area saw its first permanent European, Reed White, settlers in the early 19th century, when Pedro Fornells arrived around 1800. Bahamians had previously settled along the mainland coast, but only since about 1790, and they were called squatters by some. They included, most notably, John Egan, who had received a land grant from the Spaniards during the Second Spanish period. His relatives all received land grants, doled out in 640-acre parcels from the U.S. government as well. Since then, Miami has been sort of like Mehitable the Cat of Archie and Mehitable and Shinbone Alley fame, a bit disreputable, completely lovable, a bit crazy, using up multiple lives, but toujours gay, toujours gay.
Sparkled like golden champagne. It's cheerio, my deario, prance and pirouette. It's cheerio, my deario, there's a life in me yet. Toujours gay, toujours gay, toujours gay, toujours gay, toujours gay, toujours gay, toujours gay.
The Cape Biscayne Lighthouse was constructed in 1825 to warn ships away from the treacherous reefs, and a plantation was established by Richard Fitzpatrick in 1830 that grew sugarcane and tropical fruits. And for a while, it seemed like things might go well. But by 1836, after the beginning of the Second Seminole War, he thought better of the venture and shut down the establishment. 6 years later, after the war had resulted in the annihilation of the native population, Fitzpatrick's nephew charted the village of Miami. By 1850, there were 96 settlers, and Miami had become the county seat, just in time for the Third Seminole War, which lasted from 1855 to 58. Miami, it seemed, was not destined for a career as a great American city. However, during the latter years of the 19th century, one family, the Brickells, Miami River settlers, operated a trading post. The city's growth and development really wouldn't come until the end of the 19th century in 1890, when Julia Tuttle, a Cleveland widow, bought 640 acres and decided to make her life in South Florida. She attempted to persuade railroad mogul Henry Flagler to expand his railroad to the south, but he was unconvinced until a North Florida freeze persuaded him that the Miami climate was more advantageous. Over the years, he not only extended the railroad, but built a hotel. And on July 26, 1896, the city of Miami was formally incorporated, with 602 voters, including 100 black voters registered from the African Americans who had been instrumental in building the railroad. Now that was interesting, but not all that indicative of what was going on, as lease clauses restricted the black population to what was then named Colored Town and is today called Overton.
Hey, Jimmy, you know anybody in Miami that can give me a passport real quick? Oh, yeah, man. I got a cousin up there. He knows everything about everything. Let me see if I got his number here somewhere. Yeah. No, he works out of a payphone. Let's see. Oh, yeah, I got it here. Okay. Yeah, he's international investor, whatever that is. Yeah, everybody's got a cousin in Miami. It was 90 miles to beat him, but they took
then it was on. Miami was the quintessential boom town for most of the first quarter of the 20th century, with Edwardian snowbirds reveling in its frost-free winter climate. The bubble was about to pop in 1925, but then, in 1926, the Category 4 Great Miami Hurricane reminded one and all that the developing Mecca had been set in the midst of an interesting weather zone. The hurricane was followed by the Great Depression, which left the city in a pretty sorry state. But by the mid-1930s, building was beginning anew, and today's Art Deco district was being constructed to house the returning snowbirds. Miami continued to grow during the Second World War with several military training academies and communications and supply facilities that were established in the area. Post-war, the city became the jumping-off point for travel to Cuba, as the new commercials promised to take folks from Miami to Havana so that they could bathe in Bacardi. The next big bounce would also come from Havana, but in reverse, after the 1959 Cuban Revolution. Then, a growing wave of discontent with Fidel Castro's political policies led Cubans to flee the island to the north in droves. This would change the character and complexion of Miami, forever rendering it a totally Caribbean city, and more often than not, a bilingual one at that. Cultural links to the Hispanic countries to the south created a Miami ethos that attracted new residents and tourists alike from the Caribbean and other Latin American nations. But by the 1980s, the city had also become a drug mecca and the largest USA transshipment point for drugs from Colombia, Bolivia, and Peru. Ironically, This would provide the city with its next rise, as the television show Miami Vice, which dealt with the activities of drug detectives Crockett and Tubbs, created an image of Miami as a hedonistic tropical paradise where Dom Pérignon flowed, cocaine was abundant, and the lifestyle was that of the rich and famous. The glitterati flocked, and the grand old caterpillar of snowbird hideaways kept morphing into a newer and more vibrant butterfly. And it has continued to do so seemingly each decade as the years go by. Today, Miami is a tourist hub hosting international events, but underneath it is a city that shows all levels and layers of its development to those who take the time to look. Lovers of old Miami will delight in some of its historic spots. Popular sites like Vizcaya, built in 1916, and the Biltmore Hotel, which was Flagler's and welcomed its first visitors in 1926, tell one part of Miami's saga. Other less well-known spots, like the McFarlane Historical Site, tell another side of the story. The McFarlane Site was the designated black area that had been built to house the workers from the grapefruit groves that would later become a part of Coral Gables. In truth, though, Miami is not really a place for deep history. It's a new city, where the accent is on neighborhoods and on the cultural mix that makes it one of the most exciting places in the United States. In the 1960s, the population of Miami was 90% non-Hispanic white. By the 1990s, that figure had been changed to 10% non-Hispanic white. This rapid cultural change resulted in vibrant neighborhoods like Little Havana.
Me está esperando, me está guardando, que vuelva allí, cuando salí de Cuba. Dejé mi vida, dejé mi amor. Cuando salí de Cuba, dejé mi...
Although Little Havana does exist as a geographic area with Southwest 8th Street, the famous Calle Ocho, as its epicenter, it is more than that. It is also a state of mind. Visitors strolling up and down the main drag can delight in stepping back in time to a Cuba reconfigured as remembered. Men wearing guayaberas play dominoes in Domino Park at the corner of 14th Avenue. A walk of fame featuring famous Hispanic personalities runs from 12th to 17th Street along Calle Ocho, and cigar factories like that of La Gloria Cubana serve to let one and all know that this is the Cuban zone. Stop for a meal at the Café Versailles, pronounced Versailles. Billed as the world's most famous Cuban restaurant, the spot looks more like a coffee shop than the palace its name implies. But it is the unofficial headquarters of the Cuban exile community. A lunch of fufu con masitas, mashed plantains with fried pork chunks, or a bowl of caldo gallego that is a sublime Galician soup of ham, collard greens, turnips, and potatoes, can be a wonderful trip back into the past. Versailles is open until 1 a.m. every night and to an astounding 3:30 a.m. on Saturdays, or would that be Sundays? It is the place to go for a medianoche, or Cuban sandwich, carefully made from a sweet Cuban roll, ham, roast pork, Swiss cheese, with mustard and pickles, and then grilled. Remember the film Chef. A medianoche is a Miami must.
Haiti, chérie. Vi bel pays, passé un enfant. Faut moi te quitter, pour moi t'es capable comprendre valeur. Faut moi te laisser, pour t'es capable.
The Cubans were the first to arrive, but they were followed in the 1980s by the Haitians. Formerly known as Lemon City, Little Haiti, or La Petite Haiti, a North Miami neighborhood, took its original name from the lemon groves that grew in its residents' backyards. Interestingly, urban development's misdeeds, digging up a graveyard, resulted in the discovery that the area had previously been a neighborhood of Bahamians and African Americans. Today, Northeast 2nd Street is known as Avenue Félix Morisseau-Leroy. Street signs are in Creole, and the names of institutions like the Toussaint Louverture Elementary School signal the presence and the pride of Haitian Americans. Taste Haïti, chérie, in small spots like the mural-decorated Tap Tap restaurant on 5th Street, whose name evokes the beautifully decorated yet rickety transports in Haiti. There, try the banane pesée, Haitian-style fried plantains, or lombi creole, conch served Creole-style, or a plate of griot de porc, tasty garlic-infused pork chunks. Other restaurants offer similar fare. Chef Creole and Piment Bouc are two that come to mind, but it's really a matter of exploring and finding the one that best suits your taste and your pocketbook. The annual Compass Festival, held in May, is a special high point of the year for many of Miami's Haitian Americans and their guests who arrive thousands strong to celebrate the music and the culture of their homeland.
Jungle News, number one.
Most people do not realize that some of the original settlers of Miami were black Bahamians. In fact, at one point, much of Biscayne Bay was owned by blacks. Today, while the Bahamian culture is more celebrated in Key West, it's still possible to find conch fritters, conch salad, stewed fish, and other traditional fare at restaurants like the Bahamian Pot Restaurant on Northwest 54th Street or the Bahamian Connection Grill on Northwest 2nd. Miami, though, offers more than those ethnic neighborhoods and that little dash of history. There's also some serious eating getting done. Back in the 1990s, the city was home to the Mango Gang, Alan Susser, Mark Militello, Norman Van Aken, and Douglas Rodriguez, talented chefs who put their stamp on a new kind of tropical cuisine that used ingredients from the lands of the sun to create new tastes. Most of them have moved on to new endeavors and shuttered the restaurants that originally brought them fame, but their bright tastes and their way with the cuisines of the sunny tropics are in good hands with other chefs like Cindy Hudson, whose Ortenique is a don't-miss stop for me on any trip to Miami. Trained by my good friend Norma Shirley, a Jamaican chef, among others, Cindy's dishes show a deft hand with seasoning and a love for the ingredients of the tropics. Tropical foods and ethnic neighborhoods are a major part of Miami's charm. But increasingly, there is downtown activity, and the new infusions of cash brought in by the wealthy from around the world who arrive in droves for events like Art Basel and concerts at the new Performing Arts Center. These folks are about fancy fine dining and like their steaks thick and served with the best vintages. Miami has places to suit them as well, such as Trulux and the Capitol Grill, both on Brickell Avenue. Both are restaurants where steaks are aged and served in surroundings that are somewhat masculine, but with service that is impeccable. A favorite is simply a matter of taste, and I've been known to dine in each. But I also stop by some of the old line restaurants like Joe's Stone Crabs, where the wait is usually long, especially because I'm allergic to shellfish. But the people watching and the feeling of savoring a South Florida tradition make the wait well worth the while. My last time in Miami, I discovered Toro Toro at the Intercontinental and returned to savor the luncheon buffet of incredible tropical foods, only to discover that it wasn't open because of a holiday. So now I've got another reason to head back to Miami.
Get
so many things that I missed on my last visit to Miami. New museums to be investigated, old favorites to revisit, and Lincoln Road shops to check out and see what's moved on, moved in, and moved out. Then, there are the scores of new restaurants to try throughout the city. I also need to revisit Wynwood and see the mural walls again, and to check out the South Beach scene that I missed completely on my last visit. No need to remind anyone that the Art Deco buildings are amazing. And it's where my friend Patricia Wilson lived for 17 years and was my partner in exploration. Ironically, she's moving on now to my favorite Gulf town, New Orleans. But it was in seeing the city through her eyes that I first learned to love the quirky, endearing, slightly crazy place that is Miami. So, until next time.
Keep my skillet good and greasy when I'm gone, gone, gone. Keep my skillet good and greasy.